I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Adam Coffey, who is the author of one of the easiest and pragmatic books on private equity firms. It's the Private Equity Playbook. His newest book is based on a 300-plus slide deck he gave over 2 days to an audience wanting to know about rolling up an industry in a systematic and purposeful approach. The title is Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion. My interview with Adam Coffey, that's coming up next here on CFO Bookshelf. Empire Builder is a quick, easy read. It takes about 5 hours to get through. It's not academic. It's what I call an easy, right now, know-how, street smarts book. That's because Adam has 35 plus years of experience. He's done billions in exits. He has 21 CEO years, 3 companies under his belt, and 9 PE sponsors.
Isn't that crazy? Mark, it's good to see you, and hello to all your listeners out there. It's good to be back. You know, I think I was amassing all of this stuff, and you know, when I made my pivot not too long ago, I started adding up the totals, and I was like, good Lord, you know, it does. I get tired reading my own background, but you know, I still got some game left, and I'm 59. But yeah, that's the tail of the tape. 3 national companies, 9 PE sponsors, 58 acquisitions, and billions in exits.
58 is amazing. I've done my share of M&A work, but not to that level, not that count.
You know, when you just, you know, someone was asking me recently, they're like, well, Adam, you know, it's 21 years as a CEO, 58 divided by 20. That's just a lot. And I'm like, well, take my last company as an example. I did 8 in the first 2 years or first 3 years, and I did 15 in the last two. It was 23 across 5 years. And so, you know, the company before that, I was 34, you know, so it's, you know, that was 3 hold periods and, you know, different sets of shareholders, but I mean, it piles up pretty quick. When you got an unlimited checkbook and you can build a team, boy, you can move fast.
Feel free to push back on this comment. I will not be offended or insulted. Of course, I've read your first book. I follow you on LinkedIn. I am talking to someone who has a lot of energy, a lot of ideas. You're highly intelligent. You came out of a GE. You have an engineering background. I would just say that the empire building or the industry roll-ups is not for the faint of heart. Because I know some CEOs, general managers that are very methodical, they go slow, they're ultra-conservative. Is that right? Or again, feel free to push back.
Well, here's what I'm gonna answer it in on both sides of that coin. So I'll tell you that I believe in today's world of private equity and private equity backed, you know, companies, portfolio companies, it is the single largest value creation potential in any investment. You know, and it's because you can use other people's money on an accelerated fashion to take a small company, make it larger, and to create the arbitrage between the multiple you're buying these small companies at and the multiple you're selling the larger company at. It's the largest single value creation engine, I think, that private equity has going for it. But where it can be not for the faint of heart, or where people, I think most people, go south, is that they really don't have a sound strategy before they begin. I know if I put a bunch of stuff together, if it gets bigger, it's worth more, but there's no strategy beyond that. And so they just start collecting companies. And I call it shiny penny syndrome. It's if you don't know what good looks like, you can absolutely not only get in trouble, but you can derail an entire, you know, investment very, very quickly. So I think even in the world of PE, they need to do a better job of really focusing on strategy up front and making sure that they've got a sound strategy in place. They know what good looks like before they ever start. And if you pull it off and do it right, then it's the single largest value creation tool that you've got as a CEO and a PE-backed, platform company.
And I think it goes without saying, especially for the people I'm describing, they need to hire someone like you to be a part of the team that they can lean on from time to time. It's not that I'm trying to sell you and make you sound good or feel good, but someone like you needs to be a part of the team to help.
Well, I appreciate the shout out. You know, I do a lot of that today. You know, I'm going to tell you about one company I'm working with right now, and I'll keep it nameless just to respect confidentiality. But I'm working with a company right now that 2 years ago had less than $2 million in EBITDA, and today they're over 10. We're hiring a banker. It's going to sell for a nine-figure exit. And we literally did it all in under a couple of years. And we started by hiring a VP of business development and, you know, finding the financing, getting this little engine cranked up. And it's like one of the things I'm loving, Mark, about my new life is instead of just doing this to build billion-dollar businesses for institutional shareholders, I'm doing it on a small scale with entrepreneurs, and we're having a ton of fun replicating the same strategies just on a smaller scale, and it works.
And this is a shout out to the first book. They're probably sticking around to get that second check and maybe a third check. So anyway.
And why not? You know, my personal record, 5 checks, right? So, That's another big myth of entrepreneurship is you know, a lot of entrepreneurs think about an exit as being a one and done event. And I tell them, hey, this is just the first rest stop on your wealth creation highway. Why take a bucket full of gold or a wheelbarrow full of gold and go start something new when you can take your wheelbarrow full of gold and roll over about 30%, start working with your sponsor, use their money, and keep actually accelerating the pace of growth, make that second payday bigger than the first, the third bigger than the second. It's like there are so many opportunities to create wealth as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, if you just understand how capital works and understand what the mechanics are of doing this. And that's what I was trying to create with the book Empire Builder was to try to just help people understand what's required to go from startup, you know, to a million, to 10 million, to 100 million, to a billion, you know, in enterprise value. And I had a lot of fun writing it. You know, this book, like all my books, started as a seminar, started as lectures. And I gave the Empire Builder seminar back in February. It was a 350 PowerPoint slide deck. And I gave it before a live audience. And it took 2 days, you know, to give. And then that, as soon as I was done with that seminar, sat down and started writing. This was February of 23. You know, by October, here it is. And, you know, perfected in seminar before a live audience. And, you know, that's how I write.
You said something that I appreciate a lot. I can see some young, newly minted MBAs reading this book and say, I'm going to do this. I have Robert Rosenberg on my mind right now because about an hour ago, he sent me a LinkedIn message. He's the 30-year CEO of Dunkin' Donuts, and we just did a show about his company. And he said the same thing as you did. You say invest in what you know, and he believes that every up-and-coming CEO, you need to know your business. You can't be someone from the outside. I mean, you can, but it's going to be slow going at first. Could you just reiterate why it's important to invest in what you know? It may seem self-evident, but for some, again, I'm thinking about that newly minted MBA that says, I'm going to go do this right now.
Well, you know, first of all, God bless that newly minted MBA, because I'll tell you, very little wealth is created by working for somebody else. And so that newly minted MBA who says, I'm going to go find something, build it with a search fund, or, you know, or I'm going to do, you know, an SBA loan, and I'm going to dive in. I'm going to leave the Fortune 500 world. I'm going to dive in this entrepreneurial world and see if I can't make something. God bless you. You know, that's the right vision. That's the right dream, because that's where wealth is created, is by doing something for yourself. But you know, so in the book, I give credit to Warren Buffett because Warren Buffett said, invest, you know, or don't invest in things you don't understand. You know, never invest in something you don't understand. And I kind of flip that around, and I like to say it as a positive, invest in what you know. You know, and I actually took that advice once upon a time, and I thought about my own life, and I said, what do I know about my own life? All my devices are Apple, you know, and all my friends' devices are Apple, and geez, I go to Home Depot every weekend, and Amazon comes to my house every day, and Google, we all have YouTube and Gmail accounts, and it's like, this is what I knew, and I invested $100,000 in each one of those five stocks, and in 5 years, it returned $2.5 million. And so it was a 5x multiple of invested capital by simply investing in what I know. So we don't need to overcomplicate this either. I tell people when I'm working with entrepreneurs or that newly minted MBA that you just talked about, because I've literally done this 1,000 times, and I tell them, get out a sheet of paper, make 3 columns. First column, what are your skills? What are you good at? You know, what, when you think of yourself, you know, this is my wheelhouse. I'm really good at this, you know, and then I tell them in the middle column, make a column of your passions. What are you passionate about? And then the third column is if you look at your skills, you look at your passions, ideally, what kind of companies or what kind of industries would benefit from your skills and your passions? Because if we can build something that takes advantage of our skills, that happens to be a passion, we're no longer working or slaving away to build an empire. We're having fun. And we really dig in and we can find success. And then I tell people next up from that is invest in what people need, not in what just people want. You know, I want accessories for my truck. My wife wants a new outfit because we're going out to dinner. But what happens in a bad economy? When the economy goes south, people can delay spending on wants indefinitely, but we can't stop spending on needs. So I think of it's what are my skills? You know, what am I good at? Where are my passions? What kind of company? And then once I'm thinking about companies, find companies that focus on needs, not wants. And then even further, if I can find one that focuses on needs, now let's think about recurrent revenue streams. So a business where when I acquire a customer, it's not a one and done project type event, but it's something let's take pest control as an example. I sign a contract and every month I'm billing my customer their credit card. And so my revenue is like on a guaranteed stream, very little turnover. And so it's like, here's what I know. Here are my passions. Here's the type of company. It's needs, not wants. Then let's focus on recurrent revenue versus recurring or project-based. If I can do this stuff, my chances for success just got astronomically higher than if I didn't know and I just flew off and decided to try something. If I can think of it with that kind of framework, my chances of entrepreneurial success are really high. And if you don't mind, I'll just mention one more thing. If you look at this country, just this country, 33 million small businesses in the United States, but only 7% of those small businesses ever get to $1 million of revenue. And only 4% of those get to 10 million. And it's like, why does everybody fail? And it goes back to, it's, you know, I talk a lot about unit level economics, but it's needs, not wants. And it's recurrent revenue versus project-based or one-and-done type revenue. It's like there's so many reasons why entrepreneurs fail. And I like to think across my 35 years, I've actually kind of figured it out. And I'm trying to be helpful to the next generation's business leaders and entrepreneurs. I wish someone would have given me my books, you know, 35 years ago when I was starting out. But good news is, I wrote them for you, so they're out there now, and you just got to pick them up and follow the roadmap.
In the book, you use an example. It's mowing. But can we go through just a quick example of what a roll-up or an empire build looks like? Is that okay? And by the way, we can use either the example in the book, or you can make up one in another industry. We can even stick to HVAC, which I think you know pretty well.
Yeah. Well, so, hey, I don't mind using HVAC just as an example. You know, I started with a platform company. Now, in my case, that was owned by a private equity firm. It was a large platform. It was over a couple hundred million in revenue. But that search fund executive we were just talking about, you know, call it the newly minted MBA, they go out and they acquire a small business. I started with a little bit, you know, bigger up the food chain, but, you know, I bought 23 companies and I put them together. Now, the average price I paid was 5x EBITDA or 5x earnings for someone out there who doesn't know what EBITDA is. You know, and so I paid 5x. So for every dollar of earnings, I paid $5 to buy it. I buy 23 companies that look just like that. I put them all together and then I sold it for $14 for every dollar of profit that I bought. So I pay five, I sell it for 14. I make $9 of earning, you know, profit for me and my leadership team and the shareholders. And it's simply a combination of buying a bunch of small companies, putting them together. And what's happening is, as I just told you, there's 33 million small companies in the United States. They represent 99.9% of all companies in the United States. And they employ half the workers of the United States. But there's only 3,000 companies on the planet that have $1 billion in revenue. 2,000 of them are public, 1,000 are private. And so small, there's lots. Big, there's only 3,000 with $1 billion of revenue on the planet. Big is rare. Bigger companies trade for much higher prices because there's fewer of them. And so as a result of that, we're creating this thing called arbitrage. So to go back now to what you're talking about, if I use like the landscape maintenance company as a proxy, let's say we're going to start from scratch. From my perspective, the most important thing for an entrepreneur to figure out is what are their unit level economics? You know, I don't need to worry about building a $1 billion business. I need to worry about building the perfect $100,000 business. And so in a landscape, I use landscape maintenance as an example for two reasons. One, everybody kind of understands it. You know, a truck, a couple of people, they got a mower, a blower, you know, they've got, you know, a weed whacker, and they're out there cutting grass every day, all day. And so what I think about in unit level economics is, can I build the perfect small business? And so at, you know, for this mythical landscape company, my unit level economics are one truck, one crew. Can I bring in enough revenue with that one truck and one crew in order to cover the costs of operating, you know, that or servicing that revenue, the direct overhead costs? And I need to have at least a 30% gross profit margin. So I call it the 30-20-10 rule. At the operating level, I need revenue minus direct operating costs equals minimum 30%, you know, at the gross profit line. And then I want at least, you know, or no more than maximum 20% SG&A. So that's my cost to acquire a customer, to run the back office, to have somebody schedule all of the service events that are happening. Got to pay myself as the entrepreneur, you know, and so overhead 20% or less because I must make at least a dime on a dollar. And when I'm evaluating companies to buy for private equity firms, you know, or helping people, you know, with a buy and build, I'm applying the 30-20-10 rule to everything I look at. And so my goal is, can I build the perfect $1 million company? And so on this mythical landscape business, you know, we can bring in roughly $198,000 in revenue per crew. And, you know, and so how many crews do I need to get to $1 million? I can build a mathematical formula. I need 6 crews, 6 trucks, 6 mowers, 6 weed whackers, 6 blowers, and I'm going to have 1.1, you know, 8 million in revenue. And then what's the cost of each of those crews? And, you know, the two people, what's the blended rate that I have to pay? I've got to mark it up 40% for benefits. I've got to operate the truck. And so I teach in the book how to create the perfect mathematical formula for success guaranteed for the first $1 million in revenue, the first $10 million in revenue. And then I walk them through how to create the capital expenditure plan for $1 million in revenue and $10 million in revenue. And what you'll find is that in a service type business that has, you know, this recurrent contracted revenue stream, it's almost dollar for dollar. For every dollar of free cash flow I want to generate, or every dollar of earnings, I invest about a dollar. And so it'll cost me about $1.3 million, you know, in investment to have a $10 million landscape maintenance business that's throwing off about $1.5 million in free cash flow a year. It's why I love service businesses, because they're low capital expenditure. And so, you know, it's like you and I in this call can't just go through this, but it's like, you know, I recently had a billionaire that everybody knows who owns a company that everybody's heard of, had me out to his house, you know, over a holiday weekend. I went over there and he's like, you know, my company's lost its way. You know, I've had three CEOs in 5 years. People aren't fixing this thing. It's like, how do we fix world hunger? And I'm like, we don't fix world hunger, no matter how big the company is or how big the company is you already have. I peel it back to its unit level economics. I'm like, I don't need to fix thousands of trucks and thousands of people simultaneously. I need to fix one truck, one service call. You know, if I can figure out the unit level economics at the smallest unit, you know, level, I can then replicate that across the entire fleet. So I also use this for troubleshooting an existing business to try to figure out, and I'll apply the 30-20-10 rule. And so if I'm not earning 30% gross profit, I have to raise price and I have to lower my direct operating expense until I get to 30% gross profit. And if I have more than 20% SG&A, I need to focus on lowering my cost of acquiring customers, lower my cost of running the back office. And, you know, and if I can do that, I'm guaranteed at least a dime on a dollar of profit. And if I can get at least a dime on a dollar of profit, I can build any company into a billion-dollar business.
What are some of the, except for coming up with cash or getting the deal structure just right on acquisition number 2, 3, 4, what are some of the biggest hurdles for that CEO owner that's building this empire? Is it typically getting the right resources as you go from 1 million to 3, from 3 to 5? Has that been in your experience, Adam?
So I think too often entrepreneurs, you know, we didn't get into my background much, but, you know, it's recently that a lot of this started really clicking in my own mind as to why I think the way I do. You know, one of my background experiences, I'm a pilot. I don't take off unless I know where I'm going. And I deconstruct the trip by starting with the end in mind. And I think when I'm building an empire, too many entrepreneurs start a business without really thinking about what it is they're actually trying to build, how big it's going to get before they declare success. You know, at what point do they bring in, you know, potentially an outside investor? You know, what time do they sell it? You know, and I've been working for private equity building companies for 21 years as a CEO, and they always have a finite hold period of, on average, 5 years. And so I know how much wood I need to chop in 5 years in order to get them their modeled returns, in order for me to take what I want, which is wealth creation for me and my leadership team. And so it's very regimented. I know where I need to go. I can break it down into a set of activities over 5 years. And so I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, it's, I don't know where I'm going. I'm just, you know, I'm starting something. So many entrepreneurs tell me, Adam, you know, if I get bigger, I'll figure out how to make it profitable. And it's like, that's the wrong answer. It's like, we want to learn. We can't buy time. It all comes down to the one thing, no matter how much money we have, I can't buy time. And so we don't want to waste time. If we're going to fail, we want to fail quickly. And we want to recognize that we can't get to where we want to be with the current vehicle we're driving. You know, and this company that I'm trying to build just doesn't work. If I can't get the 30-20-10 rule to apply in the first million, I know I have no hope of getting to 10 million, 100 million, et cetera. And so it's like abandon, you know, move on, next idea, next thing. But if I can get it right small, I'm guaranteed that I can get bigger. And here's what I see, trying to get back to your question. You know, in the 58 companies that I bought, there was one that was an outlier that was about 125 million in revenue. Most of them, though, were kind of between, I'll call it 20 and 40 million in revenue. So let's call it 30 million. Most entrepreneurs that start a business, to beat the odds and become successful, they have to be anal retentive control freaks. They absolutely have to control everything about that business, because that was the magic that let them beat the odds and get to the first million, the first 10 million. So rare, you know, to get there, that, you know, they really had to be a control freak. But then what happens is they run out of bandwidth. And the companies just kind of top out, and they don't really have any further growth potential, because the entrepreneur doesn't change their attitude or their outlook on how to continue building a business. And what I tell people is there's another gear that you have to find. And that gear is simply this. When you're on your way from zero to that first, you know, million and 10 million and 20, 30 million, you're the first chair player in every section of the orchestra. You know, you perfect everything because you're a control freak. But when you get, you know, to that size, 20, 30 million, and you want to go to 100 million, you can't possibly get there being a control freak. You've got to find this other gear. You got to become the conductor of the orchestra. You have to be able to manage process and to articulate a vision and inspire people and then let them run, you know, and you're now the conductor of the orchestra. They're the first chair players of the different parts of your business. They're the ones who are taking your vision. You have to hold them accountable and have to help them when needed. But that's the entrepreneurial shift that has to take place. And I got to be honest with you. If you can find that gear, so I show you how to get the unit level economics right to get to the first million, beat the odds, get the first 10, beat the odds. But when you get up to that kind of 20, 30 million and you start to top out, then it's like if you can find this gear right there, if you can bust through that $30 million glass ceiling, there's a business that can continue to run, you know, beyond $100 million in revenue, well beyond, you know, into, you know, could potentially become a billion-dollar business. And so it's finding that second entrepreneurial gear. And then for CEOs, you know, when you talked about buy and build, you know, again, I'll go back to, we can't afford to buy a bad company. It will derail our growth efforts tremendously. I once, you know, saw a company that I bought that amounted to less than 5% of my revenue, but it created about 80% of my headaches for 3 years. And it's like, you can't afford that. Ty Cobb is the best baseball player ever in terms of batting average. And his career batting average was in the mid 300s. He had some seasons where he was over 400. That means that he made 5 to 6 outs, you know, 6 to 6.5 outs for every 10 at bats. If you're going to buy companies and put them together or do a buy and build, you got to bat 980. You can afford one bad deal in 20, but you cannot afford more than that. So I always tell people, you know, you're going to make the money on the arbitrage from getting bigger and becoming rare. Buy only good companies. Good companies, good leaders, good reputations, good brand, you know, in a respective industry. If you just limit yourself to good companies, so let's go back to, I'm all about eliminating your risk. So what are your skills? What are your passions? What kind of industries, needs, not wants, recurrent revenue streams? And if you can then figure out the unit level economics, it's like, and I'm all about eliminating your risk. So when we're doing buy and builds, you don't look for cheap companies that are fixer uppers. You buy good companies, you pay fair market prices, you figure out, you know, how to pay fair market prices. And then your odds of success, if you follow this roadmap, are just exponentially higher than if you just wing it.
You brought up people. Use the 30-1 rule and the versus the 8-1 rule for people. And I thought that was brilliant. Could you explain that?
Yeah. So, you know, it's incumbent on us to try to keep our cost structure down as much as possible. It's hard to be successful. It's like we have so many pressures on, you know, especially in today's world, our supply chains are disrupted. You know, there's inflation, there's high interest rates, there's all this pressure on us. And so, you know, when I started off in the Fortune 500 world, if you're talking about span of control, you know, I'll remember, you know, that Jack, you know, Jack at GE, you know, the goal was we don't want any more than 5 layers of management between a line employee and the CEO. You know, if we can get away with 5 layers or less, you know, that's ideal because we want our span of control to be a minimum of 30 employees per dedicated manager. So if you think of, you know, if I go back to early in my career, I'm a service manager. I'm a boat anchor. You know, I'm, you know, I've worked my way up from guy in truck, good service, you know, engineer to now I'm the leader of a team of people. You know, I've got 30 engineers working for me and, you know, I'm a boat anchor. I'm overhead. Well, how does one person do 30 reviews? You know, how does one person manage 30 people? Well, we create different levels, but you know, I had three different leaders. Each of them was a working supervisor. So they're revenue generating. They may not be working, you know, call it the 40 hours a week in the trenches. They might be working 25 hours a week or 30 hours a week in the trenches. But they're a working supervisor. They're still responsible for revenue creation and generation. And they would help me because they could each lead a team of 10 people. And so then by the time you get up to me, you know, you've got this 30-to-1 ratio. And the 30-to-1 ratio is worker bees to dedicated 100% overhead, you know, manager. And when I'm running or looking at small businesses, you know, we start real lean. But as we're adding structure, we're gaining size. What I typically find when I get into a company, even if it's got $100 million in revenue, you know, what I find is about an 8-to-1 ratio, you know, and I find that we create layers, you know, and we just don't have enough people per dedicated manager. And what happens is our cost structure, our SG&A, our overhead starts to get out of whack. So I like to really focus on being lean and empowering people to make decisions at the lowest possible level in the company so that I don't have to have all these different layers of management. Use working supervisors when you can to augment those dedicated managers to make yourself more cost effective. That's what I was getting at when I talk about that span of influence. And I'll tell you this, a happy medium is, can you get to 15-to-1? 15 people for every dedicated manager, because most small companies I look at, you know, even up to 100, you know, 150 million in revenue, you know, they it's about 8-to-1, 8-to-1, 6-to-1, 8-to-1. That's what I see as typical. Maybe Fortune 500, 30-to-1 feels like a bridge too far. Can we get to 15? Can we just look at how many people does it really take to get the work right done and to make, you know, and a lot of it has to do with that decision-making authority and matrix. If I hire people and I push decisions down to the lowest level in the organization, first of all, I create a nimbler company that's much faster at making these decisions, and they're making them in front of the customer, which is the right place to make these decisions. But then I also require less management, and I have to teach those people how to make good decisions, and I've got to be willing to live with some bad ones. But it, you know, if I can shoot for going from 6-to-1, 8-to-1 to 15-to-1, you know, I'm lowering my cost structure dramatically.
Do we have time for a quick lightning round?
Absolutely.
This will be fun. So I'm just going to read a few terms. Take a minute, 90 seconds to respond. We'll go to the next one. And by the way, I want to say one more time, if I haven't said it already, I read this book in two settings. That's how good this book is. It's how accessible it is to read. And one of the things I do is I always highlight terms, concepts. So some of the terms we're going to hear in the lightning round are based on what I do when I read. Some of these you may think, why did he bring this up? But just work with me. The rule of 130.
So the rule of 130 simply says this. If you take your age, you're an entrepreneur, you own a business, you want to know when to sell it. Take your age as a two-digit number. Add to it the percent of your net worth, you know, that is tied up in this illiquid thing known as your business. If you add those together and it's over 130, it's probably time for you to diversify by selling at least a minority position in your company and diversifying your asset base and getting some chips off the table. And the reason for that is if it's over 130, chances are you're of an age where you may not have enough time to recover should something bad happen to your business. Think of the pandemic and all the negative, you know, the government decided who got to stay open and who didn't. A lot of businesses were forced out of business during that time period. So the law of 130 is about when to sell.
By the way, I did a Google search on that. You may have gotten the idea from someone, but the rule 130 does not exist except for in your book.
I wrote it and created it. Okay. For Forbes. It's in a Forbes article.
I didn't even get the Forbes link. So again, I thought,
It wasn't called the rule of 130. It was the article was, when's the right time to sell your business?
Well, again, this, Adam, this is brilliant. I'm going to skip around here because you did see my list up front. Let me go to the next one. Give me an example of a price escalation clause.
Sure. So service company has contracts, and oftentimes I find when I go into a big business, you know, or any business, that no one's managing price. No one is using price as the lever that it truly is to improve profitability and offset escalating costs. So if I'm going to sign a service contract, let's go back to my pest control or the landscape company. I sign a contract with a customer. That contract may say, first of all, this is a month-to-month agreement, you know, or it's a one-year agreement. It auto-renews, you know, at its term, you know, and you don't have to do anything. But I have a price escalation built in. You know, every year price is going to go up either 5% or the consumer price index, whichever is lower. You know, so I can build into my contracts an actual price escalation clause so that I'm getting more revenue, you know, and I don't have to go back and resell a customer. I don't, you know, it's like it's built in. It gives me the freedom to do that. So that's a price escalation clause.
This one's for you. I think you'll like this. And I, help me out. I thought about, and I didn't have time, I thought about going back and rereading the private equity playbook, but I just didn't have time. Did you bring up Sandy Ogg in that book?
I brought up Sandy Ogg in Empire Builder, and you know, quite in depth. And then I also did in Exit Strategy. And Sandy's got a quote on the back cover of Exit Strategy Playbook. But yes, Sandy is a great guy. He's the pioneer of what's called talent to value. And he was the CHRO at Unilever. He was an operating partner at Blackstone. And his methodology of taking strategic planning to a new level and tying, you know, the initiatives that we're focused on to who in the organization is going to do the job, to me, was really influential to my success as a business leader.
I think where I heard him was through you. See, you triggered my memory. I think you brought him up in our first interview. And when I started doing some research on him, I thought, this guy is brilliant for the reasons that you said. By the way, there are some PDF documents that, I mean, they are copyright, but you'll find them. And like I said, his content is just, it's outstanding. I love this.
Yeah,
oh, go ahead.
He has a white paper on his website, CEO.works. It's got the red cover. There's three of them, $59. Yes. Bucks. It's a primer on talent to value. If you're a CEO or an entrepreneur, it's worth the $59 to buy that white paper and give it a read, and then understand potentially how you can think about hiring key talent and who in your organization is going to be responsible for the different building blocks of growth that ultimately will help you build an empire.
Two more. I've got to get this one in because it's hilarious. I laughed out loud when you use this term, due diligence and proctology exams. I'll just stop. I laughed out loud. That was hilarious. You nailed it.
Well, yeah. So, you know, when you're selling a company, you're an entrepreneur and you're getting close to that exit point, you're failing the rule of 130. It's time to diversify. You're ringing the bell for the first time, and you're bringing somebody in. And I tell people, diligence, financial diligence, going through diligence when you're selling a company is like a proctology exam that just never ends. It's like, bend over, this won't hurt a bit. And 6 months later, they're still asking you questions. You're still creating documents and you're wondering, is there an end in sight? It's like diligence, you know, you have to just get used to this idea that when you're selling to a PE firm, you know, or a PE-backed strategic or financial-backed strategic, you know, at the end of the day, it's like they have a fiduciary responsibility to the company, to their shareholders, to their investors, to uncover every potential thing that ever happened in your business that could cause, you know, or be a red flag to help them prevent, you know, buying a company and having something bad happen after it's acquired because they didn't do the work beforehand to uncover it or find it. So there's this thing called diligence you'll go through, and it's intense. It's intense, and you can't go it alone. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, don't think you're going to sell your business without anybody else knowing about it. You're going to need help. And people, the more people you've got under the tent who understand what's going on, the better prepared you'll be for it. But it's a reference to just how intense diligence is when you're selling a company, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about after you sell your first business.
Last one. I don't think I've ever heard an author use this terminology. And I thought, this is good. PE firms keep the lights on, turn the lights off. And it's like, yeah, I get that. What does that mean to you?
Well, so most entrepreneurs, when they sell a company, they're focused solely on price. And I want them to think strategically before they talk to anyone. And so you have to think about your future. What are you trying to accomplish? What do you want your future to look like? And so if you are 70 years old and you want to retire, well, you know, if you sell to a PE firm, they're going to want you to stay, become a rollover investor, and they're going to want you to work harder than you've ever worked before because they just gave you a wheelbarrow full of money and they need their return too. And so, you know, if you're 70 and you really want to dial back and retire, you know, a PE firm may not be the right buyer for you unless you've got a number two, you know, who can take over the business and keep moving it forward. When you're selling to a strategic, there's two kinds of them. You know, a PE buyer always wants to keep the lights on. They want you to stay. They want you to be a rollover investor. They want to join you at the hip with them and their success. When you're selling to a strategic, there's two kinds of strategic. Those who keep the lights on welcome you to stay. We want you to stay. There's a potential to be a rollover investor, you know, or a stock investor, you know, use a portion of your proceeds. We want you to stay, join the team, and become an integral part of our business. That's keep the lights on. Keep the lights or turn the lights off is when you're selling your company and it's like, look, I don't need you. I just want your book of business. I want your worker bees. Mr. Entrepreneur, Mrs. Entrepreneur, you can go ahead right off into the sunset. I'm going to turn the lights off. And so if my goal in selling is, hey, I want to keep working in the business I know, if I go to a turn the lights off buyer, I'm going to be out of a job in 6 months to a year and I'm not going to accomplish my goal. And likewise, if I wanted to leave, but I'm selling to a keep the lights on buyer, they're going to want me to stay. They're expecting me to stay. And so we need to think about what we want in the future before we talk to anyone and make sure that we understand the universe of buyers who are out there and which ones line up best with our own personal interests before we talk to anybody so that we don't waste time talking to people who aren't a fit for us.
When you read the book, and this is a customer of the book speaking here, so read the book the first time. Now, I cheated. I did take notes because I knew we'd be talking. But the first time, I would just read it and don't take notes. Just read it. And it does, this book does read fast. It's an easy read, but it's also very provocative. Then I recommend going a second time, slowing down, take notes. And then lastly, you don't need to read it a third time, but lastly, I would start, okay, here's my action plan to go forward. Did I get that? Is that how you would recommend reading this book?
It's a great way to do it because I think if we're focused too much on note-taking the first time through, and I do literally design my books to be five-hour reads. That's 40,000 words. You know, it's going to be 12 to 14 chapters, and it's like it's probably 5 hours for most people, and it is two sittings. It's kind of a comfortable two-sitting, you know, type of book. But if you just blow through it once, it's kind of like in life today. You know, people don't watch live events. They got their cell phone. They're watching through the viewfinder while they're at the concert or they're at a sporting event. Everybody's like, man, just watch the game. You know, and you can go to everybody else's YouTube videos later, you know, and get the play-by-play, you know, that they're putting on their social media accounts. Read the book straight through. Just enjoy it. Just try to kind of follow the journey. Then go back. I think that's the right way to do it. It's, you know, how many times do we watch a movie? And if we see it twice, we notice things that we didn't notice the first time through. And so, but still, it's like, get the enjoyment of getting through it. And then go back and burden yourself with, hey, I want to pay attention next time. That's important. I'm going to write that down next time. But right now, let's just keep the continuity and the flow going and get through it. So I do like that approach. And, you know, I also have a lot of people who buy both a written book and then they do the Audible, you know, like that they like the audiobook version, you know, just to be that, you know, that reference of I listen to it a few times. I learn more each time. You know, I get the paperback so I can dog ear the thing and make notes all over it. I can tell you this, 80% of people who buy my books buy the paperback and 20%, you know, call it buy the ebook. I don't have it with both the Audible. There's a small percentage that do Audible. There's a small percentage that want the hardcover. But most people, about 80% of the people who buy my books, buy the paperback version. And they tell me it's because they like to take notes.
Plug anything you want. Also, make sure you plug the Private Equity Playbook, because it's, to me, the book pairs well. Should you read one before the other? I don't think you need to, but you're going to have to, you need to read it too.
You know what's shocking to me, even this morning, Private Equity Playbook was number one in multiple categories. It's coming up on 5 years old now, and it still hits number one, multiple categories, multiple countries frequently. And so it became a cult classic.
It's a great book.
Yeah, but it stands on its own merit. Exit Strategy Playbook, also kind of functional, subject, expert, kind of specific to exiting. And that one, is also does real well. Empire Builder, each of these three are different. You could read them in any order. I wrote them, Private Equity Playbook, then Exit Strategy, and then Empire Builder. That was the order they were written. So there are some veiled references to earlier books in them. So if you wanted to be chronologically in order, it'd be Private Equity Playbook, Exit, and then Empire Builder. That's the order. But ultimately, it's like if I'm on LinkedIn, I don't have a team of people. You reach out to me, I do my best to respond. So find me on LinkedIn. There's also adamcoffee.com. There's adamecoffee.com. There's actually two websites. One's dedicated towards seminars and kind of engaging me. The other one is more my, I won't call it my personal. They're both professional, but it's like I've got multiple websites out there. I'll tell you in terms of my content, my books are cheap. You can get the Kindles for $2.99 each, and I donate 100% of my royalties to charity. I always have. Books were never about money. I left the CEO seat because I wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to helping entrepreneurs be more successful in business and find a higher level of success, when they're exiting or thinking about monetizing their life's work, with private equity. So I'm here to help you. Reach out on LinkedIn, go to one of my websites. There's over 150 podcasts that I've been on. That's all free, material. Great website called listennotes.com. If you go to listennotes.com, you can just type in my name and you'll bring up, 10 pages full of links to every podcast I've been on. So that's a lot of free content. I teach seminars. Those generally are from 1 to 3,000, depending on the length. I do those live. There's also some, an ability to do it virtually. And then I work with a select number of people one-on-one. And those are always fun as well. So different ways to engage me.
Can I nitpick something you just said? You said the book is cheap. To me, instead, it's inexpensive. You know why? Because, Adam, your books are priceless. So I'm going to say that your books are inexpensive, not cheap. Because, again, the content,
well, thank you.
Priceless.
I don't mean to demean my own work, right? It's. I think, somebody who reads Empire Builder, all my books, the knowledge that I've learned in 35 years, because I made every mistake a human being can make. It's not because I'm some genius. We learn by doing repetition, and getting our reps in. Well, when you've been around as long as I have and you've done what I've done and accomplished what I've accomplished, you've made a ton of mistakes. And so what I'm here to do is help you not make mistakes.
Last question. We asked you this the last time. I don't think I can ask you about your favorite books, but maybe let me rephrase the question. Other than your own titles, what may be some books that you are gifting or recommending the most as of late?
So I'm going to go old school on you, and there's a few books that I like that I think a whole generation, that mid-level, executive MBA we were just talking about, probably hasn't read. And I think if you want to learn about wealth, learn what money looks like. Learn how people who have it, think about it and kind of their own, that for me early in my career was a real roadmap, as I'm thinking about wealth creation. So The Millionaire Mind, The Millionaire Next Door, I like Jim Collins and the flywheel, effect. So Good to Great, books like that. So I'm more of the classics. It's not about every book that's out there. It's about which ones have been impactful over time. There's some Jack Welch books that were good that Robert Slater did with Jack, if I'm remembering Robert's name correctly. And, you know, and so they, there's kind of what I call the classics, you know, the cult classics. And if you read some of those, augment them with mine, I think you've got a real solid, you know, grounding on what wealth looks like and how to create it.
I will echo you. The Millionaire Next Door is one of the best books on finance ever written. And it's a shame that the author, I think the lead author, it passed away a number of years ago. It's a shame. He's someone I would love to sit down and just chatted for 2 hours, just turn on the recorder and just fire away. Great, great list. Well, again, Adam, I cannot thank you enough. Something tells me in a couple of years, we'll be talking again when that next book comes out.
Every 2 years, Mark, that's my goal. Write a book, take a year off, and then get back at it.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
There were other topics we could not get to. The PE pyramid is excellent in the book. The 30% rule and then bending the growth curve also comes to mind. By the way, we didn't get to this. I wish we could have. Adam, he is a reader. Listen to this comment. I wish I had been given all of my books 41 years ago when I was graduating high school and heading off to boot camp in the United States Army. My journey to build an empire would have been much easier and even more fruitful. So again, reading, purposeful reading, can certainly make a difference. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.